Good evening. It is Wednesday night and it is 7 o'clock, and that's okay with me. This is a time, I guess. It's a portal in which we investigate the written works of E.J. Gold, and we've done many books now, many books. I'm actually right at this particular section, second in time. I want to get back to the Joy of Sacrifice. Even though it was a very, very old one, there's a depth that I need to get back into on that sacrifice stuff. So, but we're months away from that.
At least.
So where we are now is we are working our way through one of the Secret Talks volume, number 5, called Work of Groups. We're on chapter 31 tonight, and our objective is to study the material. This is a book of that records. It's really a recording of groups working with EJ a long time ago, and it demonstrates the interactivity of the group and how EJ worked with them face to face. From that kind of material, there's a great deal we can learn. And our objective is to then notate down, are there elements of the group that we can delineate that in this particular class space we can mark down? And our scribe has done that for us. And without further ado, Pat's going to read from last week and to see if there are any notations made in the book.
There are a number of notations in the book.
Take us on a ride.
Wednesday, 6/14/17, Work of Groups, number 13. 1. Operations of a group. 1. The purpose of speaking in a group, declaring an effort to be made, is sometimes self-revelatory. 2. Harry's example. Looking how to serve the group, he discovered a work principle that appeared theoretical, but when said in the space to the group, it reflected back on him, demanding action so he could be a conduit for higher force. 2. A group's vibratory sensation sets a bar of presence into which I come. I rise to it and am cleansed of the ordinary mechanical self. From repetition, I can find my way to it. 3. As Bardo's faces become more apparent, a group can appear, for instance, in the form of this Wednesday evening broadcast and be able to hold a post and provide hospitality to travelers. 4. Groups can provide the space for this teaching to come alive in its transmission when it's offered and shared. 5. A working group space may provide the law of resonance to a higher space.
That's very subtle. Yeah.
5. A working group space may provide the law of resonance to a higher space. I think the verb provide is difficult to work with, but I understand.
It may. Correct.
It may, yes.
There's a potential.
It may provide.
Probability there.
It's possible, yes.
Yeah. Very nice. Thank you, Pat.
Yes.
And I want to add one that as I'm listening to Pat, and I'm listening, I'm watching the flurry of activity. One element in this particular form of group is administrative,
mm-hmm.
one that we show up.
Mm-hmm.
And then in this case, since we're also virtual, that we are able to do cameras and microphones and phones and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some basis in that too. It's a servant to the space, that aspect of it, but it is also important.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how are we doing over there, Dan? Okay. Good.
Good.
Dan's over there having an adult beverage while the rest of us are starting the class. Yeah, it looks like it.
T. It's a T. I said adult beverage.
I didn't say we're kind, it just. Okay, chapter 31. This is a very, we're in a series of really small, short little pithy chapters here, Pat.
Yep.
And I'm really, this one is huge. It's even, like just barely over a few sentences long. Why don't you go ahead and read it, and then there's a couple of things I want to, I have examples tonight.
Oh, good.
We have examples.
Okay. Secret Talks 5, Chapter 31, Glimpses of Big View. Transformation can come only with effort. Those who try are more possible initiates than those who just hear and dream. We must learn how to really learn, not just collect mental data. Do not expect to know without having learned. We must realize that we do not come to a school knowing everything already. Before we can learn something new, we must know exactly what we know.
So can you read that first sentence again, just the very first sentence?
Transformation can come only with effort.
Well, Silverdale, of course, when I read that, I was thinking of you, but.
Me too. When David read it, I thought of you.
Yeah. So I found, after I read that, I was thinking about it for a while, and then I figured out a very esoteric secret about it. And I'd like to share that esoteric secret with the group tonight.
I feel sure about that.
I am totally sure about it. It was revelatory.
Okay.
And I'm certain that it's something that I discovered it.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm aware of that.
This is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Brand new revelatory data. So anyway, I'm taking Spanish classes now, all right?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a wonderful teacher. She's pretty tough on me. And so we're actually meeting twice a week.
Good.
Okay? And then here's what I discovered. I found that when I put in more time on studying and working through the exercises, I do better in the class. I actually am progressing faster. Isn't that amazing?
You bet. It is.
I mean, it's like, so I put in more work,
and more results occur.
And more results. Who would have figured that out?
Only you, so far.
I would have to say that for many present college students, that's esoteric knowledge.
Ivan, I think for many of the people in this group, it's esoteric knowledge.
I'm talking from observation.
And many years of experience. The secrets will keep themselves. Not because there's anything about the secret that is hidden from us. We remain hidden for the lack of ability to do the simplest of exercises. And in my case, I have a real problem because at the end of the day, I'm going to need to speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't able to speak Spanish before.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's kind of like an objective measure.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Yeah.
And what I'm saying there is that when you put yourself in a position where that's the measurement, there's something where you must measure beyond your own. What was the last phrase there in that second sentence? Those who try are more possible initiates than those who just hear and dream. So one of the big barriers I have that is that I dream I can do it.
Mm.
I like action movies quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like the action movies where the guy, you know, is like going to beat up the other guys and he's like leaps over this.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at that and I go, yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
You can really relate.
I can relate. Even though I get short of breath, you know,
yes.
walking a block down the road.
Right.
So dreaming is one thing, but if we put ourselves in a position where, for our own standards, nobody's standard is other than your own, something becomes measurable. And how do we have, what ways or what plenty of ways do we have of never getting to it?
Well, 2 weeks back, which is the last time that I was sitting here with the group,
mm-hmm.
there was a question that you said you were going to pose within 30 minutes, and I noted during that time while we were sitting here together that I was waiting to get to that, so it like sort of set it up. It was like a prompt.
Nice.
And so then for the rest of that particular mm-hmm. week, I recalled that and thought about
nice.
What is the prompt, and I mean we've gotten thousands of them from EJ, you know, walking through doorways, dying at night. I mean, you know, we could go through the millions of examples that he's given us, but if you don't recall them and set them in place and then act on them, it, you know, they're on the shelf. They're not.
Yeah.
They're not in your capacity to do something with or about. Because they're just like, you know, a little memory or maybe
they're
a little...
flop dream.
They're not real. So what I noticed for myself after not being here last week was that that momentum had already died before I got to the end of the week. And because I wasn't here with the group where I usually establish some kind of a, you know, work effort plan schedule for myself
yeah.
for the week, I didn't have that. So if nothing else, I think the one of the ideas for me on the topic of the big view
right.
is that if it's only the small detail, which you need in order to observe, but if that's the only part of the picture that you're getting the view of, it's not enough to carry you through. You know, your habits will carry you through. It's not enough
they have to be established.
You have to have them in place, and then they have to be reactivated all the time.
Yeah.
Charge them back up again. And I've been using this group as my place where I came in for a little battery charge.
Well,
and yeah.
It's a way of putting your staff in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
It's marking your place, you know, here I take a stand. So these are developing ways and means, and each of us is particular for each of us. And that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the work can come together in the group, but individually is where some of the heavy lifting, maybe much of the heavy lifting takes place. What do you say, George?
Yeah, for sure. The way I explain it to myself is, Gurdjieff says that understanding is the blending together of data intentionally learned and experience personally experienced. So, for example, David, what you're saying is that you can learn your Spanish, but you still have to experience it through the personal effort of practice. There's a relationship. And if all we do is learn new data, okay, that's great. We know something, but we don't have any experience of what we have learned. And I know in my experience over the last 25 years, we might spend a number of years just learning the data, but then we have to spend an equal number of years attempting to reduce that theory to the practice of personal experience. So sentence, yeah.
Very nice. That makes another thought. Another thing, another element that a group brings, I think we have to bring our work, we have to test drive it every once in a while. We have to bring our work into public, in a sense, Pat. You know, like, we interact with others who are in the school, and then they can observe our work one way or another. It's a way of demonstrating, in a sense, that work. And so it's like the recital, like musicians have recitals. They work their ass off, and then they go, okay, next part of it, you got to play it in front of
mm-hmm.
your parents and everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
That's just part of it. We have to do a recital. Maybe we do a class like you guys do on Tuesdays, you know. You test drive it. And that's something we try to find a way to put yourself in that position where you, so to speak, demonstrate.
Mm-hmm.
Make sense?
Yeah, that's a good formulation.
Okay.
There is a process.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily flow exactly as you might think that it would from this sentence. This second paragraph says, not just collect mental, do not expect to know without having learned. We must realize we don't come, before we can learn something new, we must know exactly what we know. That is no simple statement there.
Ah,
the effect good. Of being able to know what you know means that you have observed enough of what you don't know to be able to tell the difference. And knowing something and thinking that you know it are so distinctly different, but if you don't get them tested, if you don't actually put them in like that class you're taking, you'll know if you know the right word or speak the right pronunciation.
Absolutely.
Or you don't. And that's, you know, that's nice to have that kind of a measurement. Some of the things that we're talking about with we must know exactly what we know, those are a little bit more, they're not obscure, but they're not immediately available. You know, you have to do some moving of the drudgery stuff
yeah.
out of your way in order to be able to actually see that or
nice.
Ponder that. You have to have a big, a clearer field in order to see what's there.
Yeah. So it is a form of self-observation to know, you know, where do you stand? What are your points of certainty? That's a tough one. It's always a tough one. They are there. They are there. There's no question about it. Go ahead.
I guess it all falls under the category of personal experience, personally experienced. If you're not practicing, then you're actually not experiencing.
Right.
Grant says, I can't believe how right on topic this discussion is. And I'm such a dreamer, but the guitar is really popping that balloon. The more time and effort, the better the result,
yeah.
But not right away.
Good
and
example.
And what I remarked on that is that practice doesn't yield steady progress. It shows up in spurts all of a sudden. And Piangelo says that some call that the Monday effect, that we practice something, and only after a rest does it show up as a personal experience.
Nice.
And then Bernie LaPlante.
The Monday effect.
Say it again.
Okay.
Say it again.
Some call this the Monday effect. That we practice something and only after a rest does it show up as a personal experience. And Bernie LaPlante says, in the last weeks I have been pondering that we come to this activity with natural talent or skill, but if it is low, we need to compensate with personal determination or effort.
Thank you.
Thanks for the
question. That's very well.
Yeah,
you
need to turn yours off.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I'm. Am I on? Now I'm on. Yeah, that's very well said. I think you know that's. I think that's another part of what EJ was saying in this talk when he was saying the more possible initiates, those who try. So you know, it's very possible that somebody might have native talent or genius or vision or be it like high psychic ability and so on and so on. But I mean, if somebody like that is basically lost in speculation or dreams or lots of ideas, but not practice, that it may not be somebody that we would see for very long around here. You know, I want to, before we pass by this little chapter, I just want to just suggest that this you know, from the point of view of the school, from EJ's point of view, this is a kind of filtering that he's talking about, which is to say, let's say, to use as an example the books that we've published from the Institute over decades. You know, I've actually had the conversation with other small publishers saying, well, you know, we have a dedicated readership, we have an audience, we have people that get in touch with us. We always put our contact information, our phone numbers, and emails and so on in the back of the books. And I've had other publishers tell me they're horrified, like, are you kidding? You're going to get all these crackpots and crazy people, and people are going to call you all the time, and you'll get, you know, the phone will ring in the middle of the night, and you're going to have all this trouble. And I can't even, it's a little hard to explain to them that quite the opposite is the case, that, you know, the people, a lot of us, I think, who are sitting here, who are in this group, you know, online now and participating with EJ, these are the people who actually not only read Practical Work on Self or the American Book of the Dead, but did the exercises, the tried thing, and then they reached a point of saying, gee, there's something I can't figure out about this. I need help. And look, there's a phone number in the back. There's an email. You know, I know Silverdale is one of those people who contacted us from information in the back of the book. So the fact is that it's a very, very tiny percentage of the readership of our books whoever uses the contact information in the back, which is to say there, you know, there's lots of readers, but not very many doers, you know, not very many people practicing what they've read.
You want to hand the phone over to
I was thinking the other day after one of these classes, something related with experience and the having some information in your mind. And to me, I think it's in my own experience, sometimes I haven't read a book or I haven't had actually information, but I've had an experience, and through having the experience, I've learned and I gather information.
Absolutely.
When there's people who have a lot of information, but there's no experience, so it cannot be that understanding. But it can happen the other way, and that's how you see peasants sometimes. They are completely ignorant in a way. They never went to school, never learned all the information, but still they could be much better mathematicians or stuff like that than a person who is actually learning for years and has a master and a PhD. It's interesting that when you do something, you might not have the whole, not need the whole information, and you develop as you go. But if you have the information and not the experience, there's not much advancement.
Yeah.
Transformation. There's not much transformation.
Not much, yeah. That's a good point.
I've heard it mentioned before that in previous historical periods, most of the people would be of a practical nature. They would be peasants, and they would have to work, and they would have to deal with changing seasons and growing crops and things like that. So that to them, knowledge was practical. There was no separation. And that the idea of a group of people who are so intellectual that they would lack practical experience is kind of a new phenomenon. It's a product of the modern world. I also wanted to mention that in thinking about, I have read books before, even books that are really instructions for doing something like practical work on self, and not really taking them in as instructions, just read them in the abstract. And I'm thinking in contrast to, let's say, Claude's books, like the Just Because Club, where it's pretty clear cut that if you're not actually doing what's written there, you're not going to get much out of it, because there's no theory presented. It's all, you know, try this.
It's not
complicated.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
Yes. I like it.
Want to ease over into chapter 32?
That would be lovely.
Would either one of you like to read that?
Do you like reading 32, Ivan?
Read part of it. Chapter 32, Country Mouse, City Mouse. Jean noticed people looked very tired and asked how much sleep we had gotten. Then he berated us for staying up late in our group meetings. He said he wanted us to be awake during the day and dependable, in quotes, to do things. He said we could not do our work if we were in, quote, half horizontal and half vertical sleep, unquote. He told us we were fantasizing if we made our group meetings more important than daily life. Did you want to stop there? Or? There are times for exhaustion and irritation, but you cannot decide when these are necessary. If you decide, you are avoiding work by self-deception. You may lose so much that someone must repair the organism, or if it cannot be repaired, you must leave the work. Some have been sent away because of this and cannot come back. Some really stupid efforts even can destroy the organism.
But God is essential that we do not do something which is harmful. Some types prefer to control the process themselves. Pride, vanity, and just a little fear. Personality is the city mouse. I is the country mouse. City mouse is very clever. He knows all the latest city slicker tricks. Country Mouse is very naive, but it is he who will survive in the work. I've observed, over the decades, I have observed people in this category that take it upon themselves to insist that, you know, working themselves in a certain way is ethical and correct, and it's absolute nonsense. EJ has described very clearly what the priorities are and always sets conditions so that people can get the tasks done without resorting to these extremes. But there have been many, many folks who have come to make, you know, big blowout effort and then they're gone. And it's just foolish. But this concept of city mouse and country mouse, this is something I have never understood. I do not get the city mouse, country mouse thing. I assume, this is my naivety, I assume all mice, whether they live in the city or the country, are mice. And so I can't quite get with the reality.
Well, they are all mice, but this is, I think it's interesting that this is another expression of just what Bernie LaPlante just shared with us and also Paula, I think, in regard to, we were talking about, you were using, saying peasants. I mean, peasants is a country mouse.
Oh.
It's somebody who's used to doing and knows how to do, to take responsibility. You know, means nothing, digging ditches, you know, no problem, doing the dishes, whatever needs to be done. I mean, those are the people that you'll see, you know, for years. Yeah, for years around.
I understand that there's a distinction there, but I do not know why the mouse is the representation of that particular understanding.
That's what
I don't get.
I thought it was a reference to a childhood fable that I learned. It might even be an Aesop's fable, I'm not sure, where the city mouse goes to visit his country cousin in the country and vice versa, and that they have different problems navigating in those, in the fields they're unfamiliar with.
The parable.
Yeah.
In Daniel, I think there's a mention of that. I saw it recently. I think the story of the mice that comes to visit.
Oh, good.
Who makes a reference to it?
In Jonson's book. And also, I think, the mice, I've always thought about it, the town and country, and with mice is a good example for me. When the town, there's all these, maybe that's a little out, but it's kind of like when it rains, it feels so much different, the city, because it kind of like the rain brings all these smells and all the dirt that stays on the floor, you know, and stuff of a city. But actually when it rains outside in the country, it's so different because it falls in the soil and it's kind of like this enriching process and it smells good and it gets this fresh. Many times when it smells in the city, when it rains, it's kind of dirty sense. So the mice life also is related with that.
I'd just like to say that it seems to me that the twist that EJ's giving to it here, if I recall in the parable, it's like it's kind of equal. It's like the city mouse is out of his depth in the country, and the country mouse is out of his depth in the city. And but what EJ's doing is he's distinguishing between the two of them. He's saying, you know, well, the sophisticated, you know, the urbane, the mental, you know, the more mental personality-oriented city mouse is the one that can't persist, you know, that can't do the essence work. You know, the country mouse is closer to the essence.
I just found the story, and basically the issue is that the city mouse is shocked at how little food the country mouse has. So he says, come on to where I live and you'll see plenty of food. And so he goes, and indeed they have plenty of food, but every time they try to eat, something interrupts them. It's either a cat or a person or something disrupting their meal. And finally, the country mouse says, I'm going back to the country because at least there I can eat in peace.
Is that an Aesop's fable?
Yes, it is an Aesop's fable.
That's the reference. Thank you.
It's a very old
yeah.
parable that's around mankind, and he's just picking it up on here.
Mm-hmm.
So, very nice. Very, very, very good. Okay. Can continue?
Yeah, you're chapter 33.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go for it.
Go ahead.
Okay, chapter 33. Desert Island Exercise. One of the people had left the group and before leaving had asked for and received an exercise, quote, for being in exile, end quote, as G put it. The exercise was given, quote, to emanate the most possible powerful presence without relying on physical posture or verbal tone manifestations. End quote. He decided to go to the barber in town before packing his bags, and that it would be a good first opportunity to put this into practice. He left the group, quote, puffed up like a turkey who thinks he is alone, end quote, as Jean described it. He came back, pushed every attempt to manifest powerful presence had resulted in automatic moving instinctive center manifestations. Not only that, but these manifestations seemed to him to be gawky and wildly exaggerated.
Funny.
Oh, it's so funny. You cannot do first time, G clucked sympathetically. He then theatrically pronounced, you go into exile for a while, master this one little thing, then when your presence is such that you are able to walk on a streetcar and not be asked for the fare, then you will be prepared to work in a school. He talked about sending someone into exile to learn something too basic to waste school time and group efforts on. Very often a simple exercise such as this can bring someone to the brink where they can accept help. G added that sometimes we stick fork, you know where, in order to make some opening through which one can be receptive to help from outside. He who is too proud cannot make a hole of receptivity himself, he said.
When I read through this, there's just so many dynamics at play when we're trying to do the one. We're doing our own personality. And then as we get stronger, we have ego about it. And then that stops us. And I mean, it never ends. And that's part of the freshness of it. That's part of the wonder of the work. It's always fresh. You're never done. And that's okay. That's okay because it's a worthy effort. You know, it's really a good thing. And so, have you ever tried this?
About the streetcar exercise?
No.
Yeah, the first one, it says, emanate the most possible powerful presence without relying on physical posture or verbal tone manifestations. Yeah. But I cheated.
She paid the guy.
No. No, it wasn't on a street course out here. I used to model. If you model, you don't talk. If you model, you don't move. If you model, you have to not care.
Right.
How you are being seen. You have to fit whatever image they want you to have. So you have to be present, but you can't be you. So I did a lot of modeling.
So I can read the exercise again that the guy had.
Okay, and going into exile?
Yeah.
The exercise was given to emanate the most possible powerful presence without relying on physical posture or verbal tone manifestations.
Have you ever tried this? Have you said something?
I don't think I've tried it explicitly as an exercise.
Dan, shaking his head. So,
yeah.
One of the keys to doing that is Pat had it bang on. You can't look to the outcome. So it's like you're trying to emanate, and the first thought is, I'm going to affect this other guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm going to make something change here.
Yeah.
As soon as you do that, you're lost. You have to get into a position of utter surrender. And it's not so much that you're trying to impress the other person, but rather that you're, can you achieve the posture of total surrender in a complex situation?
Mm-hmm.
I, who adore, Marvette gave me an accolade earlier, which
mm-hmm.
I'm still
vibrating.
It was so cool to hear. I don't quite remember what it was, but I'll take it anyway.
I won't remind you. I do.
But the point is that mechanically I'm indoctrinated for that.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see how I affect the others
mm-hmm.
out there. Oh, good. Oh, that's right. Or, oh, I'm going to back off or whatever. It's can you surrendering yourself to a position where you, in a sense, aren't there.
Exactly.
In a sense, you're not there. And then, as an impartial observer, that's all you are. What happened? Fascinating exercise to try. And to try it in different tribes.
Mm-hmm.
Different tribes.
Yeah, different communities,
different
settings.
Different communities.
Different conditions, all of that.
Like, I'm in three different events tomorrow.
Mm.
Very different, all of them. Let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say this is an invocation of presence exercise?
Of course.
Yeah, because I think in that sense, the only way in which I've done this exercise is to deliberately invoke presence, let's say, in order to enter a new space, to make a give a talk or make an appearance
right.
somewhere or other. Yeah, I have done that, but I haven't tried to assess the effect.
I believe that's part of it.
There is there's two parts to this described exercise. One of them says emanate the most possible powerful presence. So that's the one part. And the other part is, without relying on physical posture or verbal tone manifestations. Now, I was just recalling the travel that we did in Pennsylvania where we ran the Writing Down Your Life workshops at several of those, end-of-life caregiving weekends.
Yes.
And we had different components established as part of the program, which were basically tiny little slivers of moments of silence or mm-hmm. invocation of presence or whatever. We didn't call them that because we were working in a public atmosphere with not enough time to put all of that parameters in place. But that activities, and this is what made me think about this, is you as a poet have a facility with the word, and yet this particular exercise requires that you not rely on the word.
Right.
And it states that you cannot manifest through your physical manifestation. That's not the manner in which you go about it. So I recall this circle we had. I think there were 14 of us at that time. I think Tamara might have been there. Susan Plunkett for sure was there. And what we had was a space where there was a willingness to experiment. And that, for me, is the objective confirmation that we accomplished that exercise, that portion of that exercise, because people from themselves were willing to be present with us and, you know, in a certain way, bare their soul. That's the literary terminology for it. But it would not have happened if we hadn't set the space.
Correct.
So, you know, we don't make it too difficult for yourself to evaluate this. You don't have to make it something exotic. It's your daily life. Just use it with different parameters as your tools. That's all. You know, it's not anything different than what you do now. It's just the why and the how.
It's just a slight change in your mentation,
tiny,
in your point of view.
Yeah.
And that's, in a sense, what makes it esoteric. You look just behind the veil, and there it is.
Yep.
But it's you being willing to go there just for a moment. So you look here first, and maybe you'll be able to see stuff too.
Yeah.
I know you can. I know it happens.
Now, did you want to have the telephone?
Well, I was kind of going to comment what you just said, that I thought at first I didn't do the exercise, but then recalling times in my life where it was more a movement of coming in,
yep,
in that moment and kind of stepping from the situation itself when that happened. And when it's not, it's like kind of me going out and reacting and having all this stuff. So I can even feel it kind of as a sensation in the body, that feeling of like, oh, yeah, when I'm in that place, things definitely change. And the invocation of presence creates that,
yes,
scenario.
Yes.
And so when you go, just to comment on her,
yes,
when you go outside looking for verification, you literally lose yourself,
mm-hmm,
at that moment.
Yeah.
Lose it to the other. Give yourself away. Give yourself away.
So this description of what she is offering is very emphatic. You cannot do first time. So when he's giving the exercise, he's saying how the exercise is to be done. And then he says, you go into exile. And I think everybody has to discover,
yep,
their own exile. What is it you are exiled from, and where is it you are when you are in exile? You know? So then you have to master this one little thing. So what I hear in this small little piece is he offers the exercise to the group exactly, by definition, how is it to occur. Then he gives an example of how it was not done correctly, and then he says how you can attempt to do it. He says you have to go into exile. And then you have to master one little thing. So those are two huge clues about doing any exercise.
Oh,
and
exercise, yeah.
Marvette wants to have a speak. I'll be silent.
Okay. I just realized I have done this exercise. And in remembering that I have done it, I recognize exile can be looked at as a point of a shock. And sometimes that shock can be delivered by a teacher, and sometimes it's delivered by life. But then the working out of the exercise is in one's ordinary life as it proceeds.
Yep.
But that exile, that shock, can provide a banishing. And therefore, the surrender is not imposed from the outside. It just kind of is more gentle and exists, and so therefore the presence is more gentle and it exists, and then you do with that presence, and you
yes.
and you're like really aware of the opportunities in the moment, so that you can proceed moment to moment.
Well, I think it's a good exercise to understand what does exile mean in a case like this. How can you go into exile when you're sitting with five people in a meeting? You can't without being rude or anything like that. You can actually do that. So that's a very, very good practice. Dan, how are we doing over there? You okay? Good, thank you. we're getting close to the end. I wanted to actually flip to page 34, to chapter 34.
You're going to leave all of these activities on for now?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it comes up later.
Because you'll see what I mean.
Yeah.
Okay. So in 34, I'm just going to point to something as a bridge from that chapter into our next week, okay? And that is, this is a good chapter to read. It's compassionate. It's really a nice little chapter, okay, 34.
Mm-hmm.
We'll cover the end of 33, 34, and 35 next week.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to point out on page 80, at the bottom of page 80, chapter 34, our upside-down world. That last paragraph in that page says, when we see one good thing in another man, we feel good to learn that he is better than we first think. When we observe ourselves already thinking everything inside us is shit, if we see something good, we'll be happy to find more than just shit. Okay, what I wanted to point out there was, do you believe that you can objectively self-affirm something? Does the question make sense? We know about each other a little bit, right? We look around and we say, oh, that person has this skill set, or that person's this, I can rely on that one. We look and we observe that, in a sense, objectively, right? Can you do that about yourself? Is there anything about yourself that you can say that with objective review. Can you be the object of that observation, seeing one good thing in a man or woman? Person.
Yeah, you it seems to me, David, you're this is raising the question of self-observation. It's sort of like if you have a practice or have developed your ability of self-observation, you may be able to be more or less, let's say, somewhat objective about yourself. I don't know how you could ever be as objective, how I could be as objective about myself as someone else could be. But on the other hand, everyone else is also subjective in their own way.
We can theoretically spin off that way too. On the other hand, I think that let's say the three of us we stepped into another room. We objectively say some things about Marvette that are clear and distinct that we would all agree on. Doesn't that make sense? It seems simple, right? So can you do it? I'm not going to be bold enough. If we had a different setting, I would. But to say, can you speak that element to the group? Not now. This is not for now. But this is for the week. Go back to the end of 33 and then also read this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
You mean more clear about
I can. Okay, let me I think part of our job as voyagers is to, in a sense, inhabit this machine. And then as we begin to develop our work on self, the essential self starts to emerge a little bit. And then there's attributes that essential self has. So if I look across the road and I see a couple of my fellow voyagers, I can say, oh, that person does this. Like I can rely on that. It's like not even rely, it's not emotional, it's just a fact. I hesitate to give examples right now, Marvette. I don't want to give examples quite yet. Yes. Okay. Can you, so in other words, if I can say that objectively about Pat, which I can, then why could I not say it with the same enthusiasm and clarity? Because we're just caretakers here. We're caretakers of this opportunity of transformation. So that's what that, when I read that, it clicked in that we maybe need to study that quite a bit. And I thought we'd give ourselves a head start before the end of the class, even though we're not quite done with 33, because there's some very important things at the end of 33. But I wanted to get that in there, and I hope it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's all right?
For the week.
Yeah. Like somebody might have big feet. And that might be very important.
Mm-hmm.
So they would self-evaluate. Mm-hmm. I've got big feet.
Vanity, that could be a
big. You never know when you're going to need big feet, okay? So, you okay?
Looks all right. Hey, Dan, anything there?
Well, Dan was trying to say something. He said presence or abiding and not sure if I get this, and says, whoops, got to come up with something else. So
okay.
That was an effort.
Yeah.
You know, I realized I was just joking to you off the mic when you said big feet, and I said, well, you know, for someone's vanity, that could be a big thing. And then I realized, vanity, that could be a big sore thumb. I mean, that's something that could be a little difficult to observe objectively.
Well, okay, that's a very touchy point that you're bringing up. Because on the other hand, vanity, we think of vanity, vanity, pride, oh, that's a sin. I think we can observe our sins, so to speak. But take vanity. Take someone who has vanity. What is behind the vanity, if they could flip it? You know, there's a certain pride of self in a proper manner that pride is used. Okay? I'm just recalling that time when we were in the dining room and EJ was talking about the angels, and he forced us in the way that EJ does, you know, it's like a strong invitation. He forced us to say, I am angelic.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, you could sense it. It's not yours, but it is there, and you can note it. It's like what Pat was saying when she was reading the pink book there, that there's some spaces you can remember how to get back there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Maybe we'll figure out how to do it better next week. I don't know.
Well, repetition was the...
was one of them.
Was one of the code words, and I think a group's vibratory sensation set a bar of presence into which I come, I rise to it, and am cleansed of the ordinary mechanical self. From repetition, I can find my way to it. So that's like a certain type of portal or gateway to be activated, and it's, that is useful.
Sure.
I'm very curious as to how we will apply your exercise for this week.
Me too. Finish reading 33. Absorb 34.
Right.
Peak at 35.
Okay.
And then we'll blend those together.
Yeah.
Next Wednesday when we meet.
That's right.
At 7 o'clock.
That's
Thank
right.
you so much for coming.
That's great.
I look forward to seeing you next
and
week.
And Saturday at noon, we will have another round of the LRS seminar conversation. I'm so appreciative of everybody attending. I will be sending out an email tomorrow with a synopsis of our last gatherings.
Thank you.
Announcement, yes. Hand her the phone.
Marvette.
You have to share the phone.
It relates also Saturday at 10 a.m. We are doing a lab on a tool that will help you getting more of your daily activities, daily practices done, having fun, and in a way that is rather than an effort, is kind of like an adventure. So today, talking about the experience and getting the practice, this will be helpful.
Where will that be held?
That's the event name is The Unmasking. In Gorbach. Mm-hmm.
Here on
live stream.
Live stream.
Thank you.
Saturday at 10, and then Saturday probably around noon.
Noon.
For the 11th Buddhist Society.
Good.
Recap. Thanks everybody for coming.
Thank you all.
Thanks for sharing, and we'll look forward to seeing you next Wednesday. Good night.